facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A terrific Tuesday to you. It's the last day of August. It's August 31st. You know what that means. It means that tomorrow, starting tomorrow, for all the days of September, you can expect a steady diet on this program of earth, wind, and fire. But we will not subject you to that just yet. I say subject because it's one of the best songs of all time, September by Earth, Wind, and Fire. And I can't wait. I can't wait. We did that last year. We're going to do it again this year. It's going to be great. But let's enjoy the little time we have left together in August. 1-888-914-9149 is the toll-free line to call me on The Cale Clark Show. 888-914-9149. You can also email the program, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. Or you could tweet at me. You can grab onto my Twitter handle. You can follow me there on Twitter, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And we also have a show account, too, at Cale Clark Show. I feel like the show account is cannibalizing followers from my own account, but I don't know. And really, the show account is run by producer Lucas, so, you know, if you see any strange things there, that's a weird take. I'm going to blame everything on Lucas. So, no, I'm only kidding. He does a great job with the account. And speaking of Twitter, although Lucas himself, by the way, he has left Twitter. He has, this I call true. It a Lugsit, the yes, exit of Lucas, the hashtag. I wasn't able to get that trending. Yeah. Sorry, Lucas, I tried.
Well, you know, really actually, surprisingly, I haven't missed it yet. Okay. But I kind of feel like I'm still there because I am doing the show account.
You're running the show account. So right. You have all the benefits of being on Twitter without it.
Exactly.
So, but don't worry. Lucas has not deleted his account. It's still there. It's just on hiatus. He's taking a sabbatical. So if you want him to come back, just like inundate his Twitter with all kinds of messages and pleadings and plaintive cries, and he might come back. He might come back. I think he will come back. He's done this before, folks. He's done this before. But speaking of Twitter, I got a great question on Twitter, and you can also ask me questions on Twitter. At Cale Clark is my handle. And I'm assuming this is a lady. Her name is spelled T-E-R-R-E. I think it's Terry. Maybe just a unique spelling of Terry. If I'm wrong, you can correct me on that. You can reach out to me. But the tweet was, at Cale Clark, I love your show so much. Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. New questions keep coming to mind. Please tell me who John was, the one who wrote the gospel and letters. Did Jesus know him before he went public? Could he have been from Nazareth? Thank you, Terry. Oh, well, you're welcome, Terry. I'm happy to answer that question. It's great to get questions on Twitter. And again, you can also reach out to me at Cale Clark.
By the way, Cale, the subject, you know, who gave us a shout out on Twitter a little bit earlier? Sister Helena, super nice of her. She said, have lots of questions about the Bible and Catholic faith. Y'all should listen to Cale Clark's on Relevant Radio. And then I felt bad because I responded to her with a Boston Bruins gif from like all the team coming together, like, yeah, thanks. And she's like, I'm actually a Blackhawks fan. And I was like,
that's right.
So, yeah, sorry, sister.
Yeah, that was really kind of you, Sister Helena, to say that. And she's got a massive social media following. She's one of the Daughters of St. Paul, the Media Nuns, and they do such an amazing job. And they're publishing Father Harrison Ayer. And if you're on Twitter, you know that Father Harrison Ayer was with the Daughters of St. Paul for like basically all of last week down in Boston, including Sister Helena Burns. And they're working on some stuff regarding his new book that's coming out, Mysterion. And he's been on the show to talk about that. And we got to get Sister Helena on as well. So
I agree.
And she used to call herself, I don't know if she still does call herself, Hell Burns, which is kind of funny. but we'd love to have you on. If you're listening, Sister, we'd love to. Thank you for your kind words. I really turned very red. I was as red as a Blackhawks jersey when I read that. That was really kind of you to say that. And we'll have to talk about all kinds of things, faith, hockey. Her hockey fandom is a little bit eclectic. You know, sometimes she pulls for the Leafs, sometimes she pulls for the Blackhawks. A little bit, she lives in Boston, so she kind of can't escape the Bruins right now. But anyways, we'll deal with that later. But thank you very much, Sister Helena. I really appreciate that. But back to Terry's question about John. Who was John? Who wrote the Gospel of John? Did Jesus know him before he went public? Could he have been from Nazareth? Well, actually, he is not from Nazareth. I don't think so. We don't have firm historical data on this, but everything that we know from tradition says that John, the apostle, and I do think it was the apostle John who was behind the Gospel of John, and possibly the letters as well. I think it's a... we may not have time to talk about the letters, but I do think the apostle John did write the Gospel of John. And by the way, who is this John? He is one of the sons of Zebedee, the Zebedee and Sons Fishing Company that's mentioned in the Gospels. John and James, the sons of Zebedee, James and John, if you prefer. That's actually how it's laid out in the Gospel. They're also known as Boanerges, which means the sons of thunder, because, well, they wanted to call down thunder and lightning from heaven on people that didn't want to follow Jesus. And Jesus is like, calm down, guys, really. And, of course, later on, the Apostle John becomes known really as the Apostle of Love. He talks so much about love. If indeed it is the same John who writes the letters of John, little children, let us love one another. For everyone who loves knows God and comes from God, all that stuff. God is love. Yes, Deus Caritas Est. So he becomes the Apostle of Love. His heart is totally softened towards everybody from hanging out with Jesus. And actually, when I was in the Protestant seminary, we had some intramural sports, and I can't remember whether it's intramural or intermural, anyways. But one of the floor hockey teams that we had was called Boanerges, the Sons of Thunder, which I thought was a really good name. And there was another team in the league called the Philistine Champions of Gath, which I thought was even cooler. Of course, that's what Goliath was called in the Old Testament. He was the Philistine Champion of Gath. Anyways, I digress a little bit. So how do we know that John wrote John? Well, that's a really good question. And when we look at who wrote what biblical book, we can look at the title. And on a recent Faith Explained episode, actually just a couple days ago, if you want to pull out the podcast for that, I do go into the titles of the Gospels. How do we know that the Gospel of John really is the Gospel according to John? I talk about that. The titles are on all the manuscripts. So we have what's called internal evidence from the text itself about who wrote it. If it says the Gospel according to John, okay, as a superscript at the top, that's a clue. And we also have external evidence, what other people say about it. Other people said John wrote it. We're going to talk about that in just a second. But it's the same with a modern book. For example, in his book, The Case for Jesus, Brent Petrae, who I think is, if he's not the best young Catholic scholar in America, he's right up there. Incredible, incredible scholar. I recommend anything that he writes. Brent Petrae. He wrote a book called The Case for Jesus. And he talks a little bit about this in his book. And he mentioned Pope Benedict XVI, who wrote under the name Joseph Ratzinger, because that was his pre-papal name, of course. His pre-16 name, I guess you could say. So he wrote this series of books on Jesus of Nazareth. Of course, you all remember those. And they're really, really good, really well done. Everybody thinks they're great. Protestants think they're great. Because he's a true scholar. Like, he really knows what he's talking about. And he wrote the books as Joseph Ratzinger because he's like, this represents my personal search for the face of Jesus. I'm not writing it as the Pope. Of course, I am the Pope, but I'm writing it because this is me looking for Jesus. And I think that's awesome that he himself, and even to this day, is still on that search following after the Lord. And we all have to be that way. So Brent Petrae uses the example of his first book in the series, Jesus of Nazareth. Well, how do we know that Joseph Ratzinger / Pope Benedict XVI wrote this book? Well, it says right on the cover that he wrote it. It says right on the first page, by Joseph Ratzinger. So that's what we call internal evidence of the text. But what about now, it could have been forged, I suppose. I mean, there's always a possibility, but it's highly unlikely. What about external evidence? Well, everybody else thought that he wrote it. Everybody else knew that he wrote it. His close confidants talked about it. His brother, you could have asked his brother, who passed away tragically. Well, not so much tragically, because he lived a very long life. I think he was, what, 96 years old, Lucas, when he passed away? George Ratzinger, Pope Benedict's brother, very, very good churchman in his own right, was a musical guy. and they were really, really close. So he could have told you, George Ratzinger could have told you, Monsignor George Ratzinger, hey, yeah, my brother wrote that. He talked to me about it all the time. He showed me the manuscript. You know. So there's external evidence that he wrote it. And it's the same with the Gospels. There's internal evidence. So if you want to talk about the titles of that go with the Gospels, I'll refer you to my Faith Explained episode that you can check out. That was from 2 days ago. That would have been, was that Friday, Lucas, or was that Monday's episode? Monday. Anyways, so yeah, it aired on Monday, so you can check that out on the podcast, relevantradio.com, or through the app. But other stuff that's in the book that we know that John wrote it, well, it's kind of tough in a sense, because in the Gospel of John, he never calls himself John. He calls himself the beloved disciple, or the disciple whom Jesus loved. It's not that Jesus didn't love the other disciples, okay? But here's an example of this from his account of the Last Supper, which was also the first Mass. This is in John chapter 21. Here's what it says. Peter turned... Oh, no, this is actually not the Last Supper. This is the scene after the resurrection. They're on the beach. Peter turned and saw following them the disciple whom Jesus loved, who had lain close to his breast at the Last Supper and had said, Lord, who is it that is going to betray you? This is the disciple who is bearing witness to these things and who has written these things. And we know that his testimony is true. But there are also many other things which Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. And that's interesting, that maybe somewhat hyperbolic statement. Jesus did a lot of other things, and if every one of them written down, there would even be room enough in the world for all the books that would be written. And certainly there has been a lot of ink spilled about Jesus of Nazareth, libraries full of books. You could probably fill quite a few countries if you strewn all the books along the ground. But a lot of other groups, a lot of non-Christian groups, take this to use this as, for example, the Church of Latter-day Saints, LDS Church, also known as Mormonism, they use this. You might have seen this in their commercials. Ah, there are many other things that Jesus did, and some of them are in the Book of Mormon. Let me tell you about that. Well, I'll talk about that next week on the Faith Explained show, because we're going to talk about a Catholic response to Mormonism, and no, the Book of Mormon is not an authentic testimony of Christ, and we'll deal with that then. So just a little teaser for you there. But the point is, who is the person who wrote the Gospel of John? And again, Peter's following Jesus. He's walking on the beach. He turns around. There's another guy. Following them is the disciple whom Jesus loved. And the text says, this is the one who got close to Jesus at the Last Supper and said, whispered in his ear, Lord, which one of us is going to betray you? This is the disciple who is bearing witness to these things and who has written these things. So what that's telling us is that whoever this beloved disciple is the same person who wrote the gospel. It says that. This is the disciple who is bearing witness and who has written these things. We know that his testimony is true. So the text is really, really clear on that. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that John himself actually wielded the pen and wrote on the papyrus manuscript himself. And Brant Petre talks about this in his book, because a lot of ancient writers, including St. Paul, used scribes. They dictated their letters to scribes. And actually, one of them actually gets himself into the Bible, becomes part of the Word of God. At the end of the letter to the Romans from St. Paul, in chapter 16, I think it's verse 22, the writer actually kind of puts himself in there. He's like, oh, by the way, I, Tertius, who am writing this letter, say hi. You know, it's something like that. And so Tertius was this scribe that Paul was using at the time. So maybe John used a scribe as well. Maybe he didn't. So, all right, so let's keep going here. The Last Supper. Again, this is one of the places where we figure out who is behind the Gospel of John. Jesus is saying, oh, somebody's going to betray me. And when he had thus spoken, he was troubled in spirit and said, truly, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. The disciples looked at one another, uncertain of whom he was speaking about. One of his disciples, whom Jesus loved, was lying close to the breast of Jesus. You might say, hold on, why is he lying down? Isn't he supposed to be eating supper? Well, in the ancient world, in the first century, they would recline at the table. That's because the table was actually really, really close to the ground. They didn't have like a dining room set up like you and I might have in modern day North America. They would actually lie down, kind of leaning on their elbow kind of thing, like you're at a picnic almost. And that's why he's lying, and he's lying close to Jesus. Now, if you're close to the host, then it's more of a position of honor, kind of reclining there. And he says, so it says he's lying there close to the breast of Jesus, and he says to him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus answered, "It is he to whom I shall give this morsel when I have dipped it." And by the way, it's funny because Simon Peter actually has to tell this guy, whoever the beloved disciple is, you know, "Can you just like please ask Jesus, you know, who's he talking about?" So this guy is actually closer to Jesus than Peter is. Brant Peetre points that out in his book. Peter actually has to ask him. Now think about how crucial Peter is in the hierarchy of the apostles. He actually has to ask the beloved disciple who's closest to Jesus, "Hey, can you get me some information on this? Who's he talking about?" So this is part of the puzzle in terms of who this guy is. Who is the beloved disciple? The most plausible explanation is that it's John, because when you look at the other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, John is one of the 12. So obviously whoever this beloved disciple is, he's at the Last Supper. We know the 12 apostles were there. Okay, the Gospels tell us that. Plus, we also know John was part of the inner circle of the 12, because within the 12 apostles, there's the big three, Peter, James, and John. And they got to do cool stuff with Jesus that nobody else got to do. For example, when Jairus' daughter, the synagogue ruler, she's dead, she's 12 years old, they get to go in the room and watch when Jesus brings her back to life. Nobody else got to do that. They were with him at the Transfiguration on the Holy Mountain, Mark chapter 9. They were with him in Gethsemane, the agony in Gethsemane. You know, "Can you just watch and pray with me?" "No, I can't. I'm tired. I'm going to go to sleep." That's in Mark chapter 14. So this is really, really a good clue that this is John. Also, Peter and John are also really close. We know this from all the Gospels. In Luke chapter 22, Peter and John go to Jerusalem to get ready for the Last Supper. They get the room ready. They do it together. They're always preaching together in the Acts of the Apostles in Jerusalem after Pentecost, Acts chapter 3, Acts chapter 8. And when Jesus is resurrected, they go to the empty tomb. Peter and John go to the tomb together, and you know, John gets there first because he's young. He's probably a teenager when he started to follow Jesus, according to tradition. So he runs, he gets to the tomb first. Peter's kind of huffing and puffing. He gets there eventually. But John waits for him. He lets Peter go in first out of deference, because Peter is the rock. He is the leader of the 12. So despite the fact that John's the beloved disciple, quote unquote, Peter's still the leader. So a lot of biblical scholars, maybe even the majority, say that he is the guy. Father Raymond Brown, the late Father Raymond Brown, who was a very well-known biblical scholar, he said this: "When all is said and done, the combination of external and internal evidence associating the fourth gospel with John, the son of Zebedee, makes this the strongest hypothesis, as long as you are prepared to say the gospel was written by an eyewitness," which I think it was. So just before we take a little break here, just one little clue here too, is that I can say, people say, how could a fisherman write this gospel? It's not possible. There's no way he's the source behind it. Well, again, maybe he didn't write it himself. Maybe he dictated it to a scribe. But he was a pretty smart guy. Listen, these fishermen weren't dumb. This was a pretty good-sized business, the Zebedee and Sons Fishing Company. They had hired servants, so this wasn't like just a mom-and-pop operation. It was a pretty like medium-sized business. So these guys were probably pretty smart. They knew what they were doing business-wise. And not only that, John was smart because he hung out with Jesus. Here's what it says in the Acts of the Apostles in chapter 4. "The rulers, the elders, and the scribes, they're gathered together in Jerusalem with Annas the high priest, Caiaphas, John, Alexander, all who were of the high priestly family. Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John," see, there they are hanging out together, Peter and John, "and perceived that they were uneducated common men, they wondered, and they recognized that they had been with Jesus." So they were smart because they hung out with Jesus. That's where they got all this stuff from. And when it says that they were uneducated men, it doesn't mean that they didn't go to school or they didn't know how to read or write or anything like that. They would have went to the synagogue. They would have known about the scriptures. It just means that they weren't trained rabbis. like Paul, you know, when he was Rabbi Saul, he was trained under Gamaliel, the high priest, the scribes. These guys were trained scripture scholars. That's what it means. They just didn't go to seminary, if you will, but they were smart because of who taught them. And that, of course, was Jesus Christ. So yeah, there's lots of evidence that John wrote it. And there's also evidence from the early church fathers too, more external evidence. Early church fathers, people that were really close to John. Irenaeus, St. Irenaeus, who is in that Johannine line of you know, the early church fathers. Polycarp, okay, who was a martyr of the early church. He was taught by John. Polycarp taught Irenaeus. And Irenaeus said, hey, John wrote it. So there's all kinds of stuff like that too. So I think it's a pretty good bet that this is the Apostle John, and he wrote the Gospel of John. I think one of the reasons why he called himself the beloved disciple, by the way, is because we're all beloved disciples. And it's in many ways, he calls Mary woman in the gospel too. He doesn't call her Mary. It's not because he's being disrespectful. It's not because Jesus is being disrespectful. It's because she's the new Eve. She's the new woman. Christ is the new Adam. This is the new humanity that's starting up in the church here. And so Mary's at the foot of the cross with John, the beloved disciple. And John's kind of a stand-in for all of us, right? We should do what he does. He was always close to Jesus. He didn't run away. He was faithful. And Jesus says, woman, here's your son. Son, here is your mother. So with us too, like, we have to be children of Mary as well as children of God. That's what it means to be in the church. So I hope that answers your question, Terry. And maybe another day we'll have to answer this question, did John write the letters of John? Because there are a few guys running around the early church named John. I still think it's the apostle who wrote the letters too, but yeah, we can talk about that another time. So thanks for your question. Once again, feel free, everybody, to write in kale@relevantradio.com or go on Twitter @KaleClark. Love to hear from you. When we come back, I want to hear from everybody out in LA. I'm going to tell you about the dad hat craziness that is sweeping the globe. And what it means to be totally washed. And no, it has nothing to do with baptism. Be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, Lucas, I don't know what that song was, but it sounds like a very 80s vibe from L.A., you know, like I can imagine people doing aerobics and stuff. And
yeah, like a workout video or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, there's like a new series on Apple TV, I forget what it's called, Physical. It's starring Rose Byrne. Who's in the show called Damages. I love Damages. That was a cool show ever. Anyways, I digress. But it's about like sort of that era, like the 80s, Jane Fonda type stuff. And anyways, I'll have to check it out. But speaking of LA, I want to hear, by the way, if you're an Angeleno and you're listening to this, I want to hear from you about this. 888-914-9149. We have a lot of fans, Lucas, in Los Angeles. Our show trends pretty highly out in LA, and I think that's really cool. So thank you for that. And I read a cool story actually in the LA Times about, and this is part of the fun aspect in the Cale Clark Show. We really talk about three things: faith, facts, and fun. This is the fun part. You'll have to be the judge of this, how fun this is, but I thought it was fun. Dave Schilling, writing in the LA Times, he was writing about the dad hat obsession in Los Angeles, and he calls it the city's biggest experiment in being totally washed. So let me just define a couple terms for people, because I had to look this up myself. What does it mean to be washed? Well, I had to consult the Urban Dictionary, of course. And to be washed means, well, it's a term, it's an adjective used to describe a general feeling of exhaust, tiredness, and lack of motivation. For example, after a long day at work, one may experience the feeling of being washed. Okay, so that's washed, but also it could mean something else. More tragically, somebody could be washed up. They might be over, canceled, passé, not cool anymore. And in many ways, that's a little bit what it feels like to be a dad, right? You're exhausted, you're tired, you feel like you're not cool anymore. Well, LA's dad hat obsession is the city's biggest experiment in being totally washed. Well, what is a dad hat? What is a dad hat?
I have to say, Kale, when you first mentioned this topic to me, I was really confused. I'd heard of dad jokes, dad dancing. I'm like, okay, there's another category, apparently, dad hats.
That's right.
But then I saw your explainer picture on Twitter, and I was like, okay, this is
I posted a picture. It's sort of an anatomy of a dad hat. You can check this out on my Twitter account, at Kale Clark. But here's the definition from, I had to look this up. I had to Google this. So I found this on Elle magazine, of all places. So they say a dad hat, simply put, is a baseball cap. But it's not just any baseball cap. It's not a snapback. It's not a flat brim. It's not fitted. It's 6 7/8 or however big your head is, you know, like Major League Baseball caps. A dad hat is a baseball cap that's made of canvas or cotton, has a slightly curved brim, not too curved though, and it's probably a little oversized on your head, unless, of course, you're actually a dad, and then it probably fits you perfectly. So that's a dad hat. We've all kind of seen them, and if you saw one, you would know, that's a dad hat. So Dave Schilling, writing in the LA Times, says this has like become ubiquitous on the streets of LA, especially among parents, it's not just parents. And by the way, it's not even just men who wear the dad hats. Women wear these hats too. And this is actually part of a series of stories in the LA Times called Parents Are Cool. Okay, so there you go. We are cool, whether you like it or not. So he talks about other items like mom jeans that you might have heard about, boyfriend shirts. But he said the dad hat is more like a vibe. It's more of a generational aesthetic. It's kind of this vague sense of giving up. Dad hats are the universal symbol of the person who's simply out of time. Time to think, time to care, and time to prepare. The dad hat is named as it is because fathers slowly but surely lose their sense of fashion. We drop the pretense of trying to impress strangers and submit to a fully functional idea of how to dress. Tevas are comfortable, you know, like sandals or Birkenstocks. These shorts have an elastic waistband. That's kind of convenient. I don't have to wear a belt. If I put on a dad hat, I don't have to wear as much sunscreen. Ah, the joys of sublime practicality. But life in Los Angeles is not strictly practical, right? It's a city full of people with an unnatural aversion to the very concept of getting older. There are entire industries dedicated to lifting, tucking, sculpting the human body to more accurately resemble one that's not falling apart slowly over time. So why would anyone be caught dead wearing a hat with the word dad associated with it? Well, that's a really good question. And he attempts to answer it in the article. He says, look, when it's simply too difficult to look good, you can always rely on the dad hat. It's unstructured. It's usually visibly weathered. You can check out the pic again on Twitter. You can just even Google yourself images of dad hats. It doesn't stand out. It doesn't draw attention to itself. It's comforting. It's a utilitarian device for hiding if you're famous enough to need such things. So think about all the pics that you see of celebrities who are kind of trying to go incognito. They're going to Starbucks or whatever, and they're wearing their mirrored aviator shades, and they're wearing dad hats. And by the way, these are men and women celebs. That's the kind of thing that you'll see all the time. If you're famous enough to need such things, you can always throw on a dad hat. And during the pandemic, of course, dad hats were actually pretty practical because they could keep your long, scraggly, uncut hair in check during your emotionally and physically fraught outings to the grocery store. So they're kind of like, he says, an Allen wrench. Everybody has one in the drawer lying around just in case. They're super convenient. And just like people like to wear Crocs, they like to wear Birkenstocks because they're easy, they're practical. The dad hat is kind of like that. It's easy to put on, it's fun to wear. They're like socks or underwear. They're necessary for life, but they don't require any kind of care or attention. And they've actually become kind of a fashion accessory. Producer Lucas. In fact, I in the article, there's some links to some major houses of fashion that have made the dad hat kind of this like runway staple.
I can't say that I'm surprised by this, to be honest. Yeah. So well, it's funny because actually what's starting to trend again amongst like Gen Z, like high school and college age kids right now, are wearing fanny packs.
Yes.
And I feel like dad had to, like, it's almost like the cool thing to do is wear something that's uncool.
Yeah.
It's a paradox, but it's like, I feel like a dad hat might fit into that category. It's like, I know it's not cool, but like, I'm wearing it because I feel like I'm part of this scene.
Yeah. Well, you're right on there. And by the way, you can call in if you're a dad hat wearer or you'd like to be, 1-888-914-9149. If you're an Angelino, if you're out in LA, if you see this on the streets all the time, I want to hear about this. Actually, this is what he talks about in the article. This is Dave Schilling again, writing in the LA Times. And he said that this is actually like a trend that's happening. Like you said, Lucas, you know, other trends from the 80s, the 90s are coming back, these fanny packs. In GQ magazine, a style writer named Jason Diamond, he actually called this phenomenon bistro vibes. It's a whole phenomenon called bistro vibes, which means the need for upwardly mobile individuals to dress like their parents. It's an attempt to capture the casual sophistication of Hollywood in the early 90s. Double-breasted blazers, convertible BMWs, a time when men would wear straight-leg jeans on the red carpet, a time for dad hats. And so modern-day celebrities are really into this. And he gives you, I don't even know who this is. I should know, because I like to think I'm dialed into the bleeding edge of culture, but I'm really not. Timothy Chalamet. Have you ever heard of this guy, Lucas?
I actually don't know who that is. No.
Okay. His name is spelled Timothy with two E's and like one of those accents over the first E. So it's T-I-M-O-T-H-E-E, and the first E has that accent over it. I forget which one it's. The accent aigu. I forget which one it is. Anyways, Timothy Chalamet, C-H-A-L-A-M-E-T. Apparently he's a famous actor, a celebrated young actor. And whenever he puts a picture of himself on social media wearing anything, people go nuts. Like, they post all these memes about it, and he posted a picture of himself wearing a dad hat the other day, and there's a link to it in the story. So this is like the thing to do. And he says, look, people like Timothy Chalamet are responsible for young people all across Los Angeles choosing to look like they have a mortgage and a 10 o'clock tea time. In other words, they want to be like their parents. So anyways, apparently this all goes back to, in terms of how this trend got started, Kanye West. And you know how Kanye West has, and I just found out about this, he just released this new album, Donda. It's got a cool song on it that we used as a rejoin the other day. Love that song. So he had another album that came out, I think it was also an album, it's called The Life of Pablo. And what I didn't know about Kanye West is that he's become this huge style icon, and he's sold millions and millions of dollars of merchandise, like hats, t-shirts, streetwear, and he's like a real cultural trendsetter. So he was the one who kind of started wearing these dad hat caps around this time. This is, I think, back in 2016. And this became this huge fashion trend. So anyways, there it is. So dad hats are not only comfortable, and they're fun, and they're easy to put on, they're not quite a replacement for a personality, as Dave Schilling writes, but it could be if you wanted to try. And dad hats are a comfort to cling to in this uncomfortable world.
Well, Kayla, I have to ask you if you have one.
I do.
You do?
Of course I do. I'm a
dad.
Are
you wearing it right now?
I'm not, because I'm wearing my headphones, but I'll have to post a picture of myself in a dad hat later.
All right, do it.
And I'm totally like that. I'm totally into this. You know, I'm a dad. I'll throw on the Crocs if I'm going out, you know, to walk the dog or whatever, and I'll throw on the dad hat. But it's nice to know that this is actually, I'm now on the bleeding edge of culture as I do this. And I did that during the pandemic when I couldn't get my hair cut. I just throw on the dad hat, tuck it in, you know, throw on the shades. Man, that guy's cool, man. He's like Timothy Chalamet or something. but in actuality, and it's true. So it's nice to know that not really caring about your parents is actually caring about your parents now, because that's important for us to do that.
That's true.
It's important for us to do that, because we can as men. We tend to let ourselves go, especially after we get married. I don't know if that's happened to you, Lucas, but you don't, because now you think, if my wife wants to break up with me, she has to get an annulment. She's probably not going to want to do it. Yeah. It's too much paperwork.
Well, it is funny because there's also this debate going on amongst people about how often you should shower.
Oh, and, yeah. That is a big thing these days.
And I will say that
celebrities are big into this.
Yeah. I tend to fall into that category where I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to throw on a hat because I'm too lazy to actually shower today. Or
Wow.
I can't say my wife supports this decision, but
she's maybe probably cringing right now.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
But Gina, yeah, he's really sorry.
But on a different note, I think a Catholic take on this whole phenomenon is embracing the uncool to be cool. I mean, as Catholics, mm-hmm. we can't be comfortable in this world. And I really like the idea of, like, you know what? I'm going to wear my saint medals all across, like my 30 saint medals all across, you know, whatever Catholic, have your rosary out, all this kind of stuff. And it might be quote unquote uncool, or you might be like embarrassed because it's like, I'm too overtly sharing my faith. But actually, like, people might think, hey, that's kind of cool. That's different. You never know. It could be an evangelization tool or something.
It could be. There's kind of a counterpoint to that too. Do you really want to wear a Catholic t-shirt every day? Do you really want to be that obvious about it? Not that you're ashamed of it or anything like that, but
yeah, that's true.
But would that turn people off? Would that turn some people off if you were too obvious about it? If you're wearing this big, gigantic, there's this guy in my parish who wears literally a pectoral cross. He's just a lay guy. He goes up and he does the reading at Mass, and he's got this giant pectoral cross, like one that a bishop would wear. It's massive. It's this massive iron cross. He wears it around his neck. And I want to ask the guy, like, oh, wow, what diocese are you in charge of? I mean, it's, I don't know. I don't know about that. But
maybe I'll wear a shirt with just a big peacock on it, and it'll be a subtle way of showing people, why are you wearing a shirt with a peacock? And I'll be like, it's a mystery. Subtle nod to Father Harrison there.
But
if you have like a weird shirt like that, people are like, that's kind of different. And then you can actually explain to them, well, this is why I'm wearing a giant peacock on my shirt. It's because it's a symbol of the faith.
do we have time to take this call?
Yes, we do.
Okay, good. We're going to go to Pete in Wisconsin right now. Hey, Pete.
Hello. I think it's about time the hat or cap made a comeback, because we've all had cold heads since the Kennedy administration.
That's true.
The hat kind of disappeared when JFK was president, because he had a great head of hair,
mm-hmm.
and he was rarely seen wearing a hat.
That's
In
true.
In fact, I bet you can't name ever seeing him with a hat on, can you?
Never. I've never seen him with a hat. Even pictures of him playing golf, he was never wearing a hat. Okay, yeah, maybe.
I saw him once with a picture of a top hat. And my dad was born in about 1929, and he said when he was a boy, if you went, you know, to a ball game or something and saw a boy or a man without a hat or a cap, mm-hmm. it was mm-hmm. something you talked about on the way home.
Yeah,
everybody wore a head covering of some type.
You know, yeah, hats are coming back. Like, not just these sort of schlub dad caps, but also just gentlemen's hats. I know a lot of people, they're wearing stylish hats these days. So it's a trend that I think is kind of cool. It's kind of nice that gentlemen's hats are coming back. I think that's really neat. I love that. So that's a really good point, Pete. Did this all start with JFK and, you know, really at the advent of television? Everybody who was listening to the JFK Richard Nixon debate on the radio thought that Nixon won, but everybody watching on TV thought that Kennedy won because he was so much more charismatic looking. And is this really when image started to trump substance? I don't know. But that's a good point, Pete. So thanks all for the call. Really appreciate that. That was Pete calling from Wisconsin. This number to call, once again, 1-888-914-9149. Well, when we come back, we're going to not talk about the dad caps anymore and your pictures that you're posting of yourself wearing them on social media. But we do want to talk about something else that goes hand in hand with that. It's patience. How do you keep patience when everybody else around you is losing their cool, whether it's in social media? How do you keep patience with yourself in your own personal struggles? Well, we're going to talk about that with the help of our old friend, Holly Ordway, right after this break. Going to be right back on the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Whenever you
call me. Hey, welcome back. When you call me, I'll be there too. 888-914-9149 is the number to call, 888-914-9149. Hey, It is somebody's birthday today, so if she's listening, Dr. Holly Ordway, good friend of the program, it's her birthday today, August 31st, so happy birthday, Holly. And we'll pray for you in a special way today. And she's written a nice little post on the Word on Fire blog about patience. And of course, she's very literary minded. We had a great interview with Dr. Holly Ordway on the show recently, and she was actually a professor of our own Lucas Holt, and he learned a lot from her, and I did too when she was on the show. We're going to post a link to that interview in the show notes. It was a lot of fun. We'll have to have you back on soon, Holly. But she's posted this really cool story about patience and how hard it is to be patient. And she kind of talks about this, saying that, you know, in your day-to-day life of being a Catholic, it's necessary to be patient. I mean, patience is a virtue, right? But it's also really tough, because there's so many things that, and she uses the term goads, and a goad is a farm implement. It's kind of a sharp thing that they used to use to get the oxen to keep going, keep plowing the field, kind of spur them on. And that's why Jesus said to St. Paul, when he appeared to him on the road to Damascus in Acts chapter 9, it is hard for you to kick against the goads, the ox goads. You know, when you're fighting against me, you're really hurting yourself. It's not going to work. And so she says the media is full of goads to be impatient with yourself, impatient with others, and impatient with the world in general. Why are things not the way they should be right now? Surely there's something that I or everybody else ought to be doing. Giving that doing something very often translates into being angry on social media about something. This impulse to do something ought to be interrogated quite intensely. And that's a really good, insightful point, because when things are not going the way they should, whether it's in your own life or in society, we tend to want to look for the quick and easy way out. For example, you know, if there was a hypothetical book called Three Simple Steps to Overcoming All Your Sins, and people would probably buy that book because they want a quick fix. It's not easy. Or fixing society. There's all these problems in society, and people want to lash out on social media. And so doing something about the problem is very often being angry about a problem. And that's not really helpful for us. And Holly Ordway says that, believe it or not, the situation when you go on like Catholic Twitter, it's just a war zone. And she said, really, things haven't changed that much. The more things change, the more they stay the same. She's been looking into 19th century English Catholicism. And back then, there was a huge controversy in the church, just like there are many controversies today. And the biggest one that people were talking about at the time was what was going on with Vatican Council number one, Vatican I, and their definition of papal infallibility. This created a lot of controversy, and people were fighting. Catholics were fighting against each other. There wasn't social media. There was no Twitter back then, but there was newspapers. There were pamphlets that people would, you know, print off and slip under people's doors and post in public places. There were angry letters that people would write to each other. And there was lots of heated rhetoric amongst Catholics. And a lot of Protestants who were kind of standing on the sidelines watching this, they were like, man, this is not cool. I don't think I want to be Catholic. These guys can't even agree with each other. And so in the midst of this was the Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins, the Catholic poet Gerard Manley Hopkins. And he was kind of kicking around at this time, and he wrote this poem called Patience. And it's a really cool poem, because it's a poem that can help us be more patient with ourselves in our own spiritual struggle or lack of growth, you know, whatever. And also, how can we deal with the world around us, which is really noisy? It can induce a lot of anxiety. And we have a lot of pressure on ourselves, like inward pressure, outward pressure. There's economic pressures. There's pressure from the coronavirus. There's pressure from this, pressure from that, pressure from the culture. How do we deal with that? So this poem by Hopkins called Patience might be able to help with this. So I'm going to read it. And as Lucas was telling me, I've never read this poem before, but as Lucas was telling me off air during the break, Hopkins is actually one of the toughest poets to read, because of the way he writes. So if you don't understand it, if it doesn't make any sense to you, don't worry about it, because we're going to break it down with the help of Dr. Ordway. She kind of explains everything. But Lucas, is there any, do you have any poetry reading music we can use? I'm just going to slip into my smoking jacket and my pipe and step into the library. Here we go. Patience by Gerard Manley Hopkins. No, I'm not going to read it in an English accent, but I'll just read it. Patience. Patience, hard thing. The hard thing but to pray, but bid for, patience is. Patience who asks, wants war, wants wounds, weary his times, his tasks. To do without, take tosses and obey. Rare patience roots in these, and these away, nowhere. Natural heart's ivy. Patience masks are ruins of wrecked past purpose. There she basks purple eyes in seas of liquid leaves all day. We hear our hearts grate on themselves. It kills to bruise them dearer. Yet the rebellious wills of us, we do bid God bend to him even so. And where is he who more and more distills delicious kindness? He is patient. Patience fills his crisp combs, and that comes those ways we know. Okay, well, great musical selection, Lucas. That was very nice. That was very nice. Kind of took me away. Felt like I was in the Bodleian Library or something in England. Anyways, so what does this poem really mean? Well, he starts off by saying that waiting is really difficult, as Holly Ordway explains. That's why he writes, patience who asks, wants war, wants wounds, weary his times, his tasks, to do without, take tosses, and obey. So the one who wants war and wants wounds, he wants to kind of get into the battle, kind of wants to get after it. And that's kind of what she was talking about earlier. When there's like a, we always want to kind of lash out. When there's a problem, we kind of want to get into the fray. We kind of want to try to do something about it. And that's even true when it comes to our own spiritual faults. We want to fix ourselves. And that's not always easy. Sometimes we have to bear the cross. And that's why Hopkins writes, you know, to do without, take tosses and obey. We're called to bear our cross, Ordway writes, whatever it may be. Though sometimes what we are called to bear, it's not exciting, nor is it dramatic. It might simply be gritting our teeth and not posting a snarky remark on Twitter. So when we're called to be patient, we may instead wish that we had war and wounds to deal with, conflicts and struggles that demand clear, direct action. Instead, our task may be to do graciously without, to do without, to take tosses and obey. And she says that modern people, especially modern Americans, don't like that much at all. And Americans are doers. They like to do stuff. They like to do something about a problem, and they like projects to work on. And we only like to obey if we agree. But it's in being obedient. It's in self-denial. It's in acceptance. Obedience of what is given to us that true patience puts down its roots. And there's kind of this cool thing in the poem. Hopkins talks about natural heart's ivy. Masks are ruins of wrecked past purpose. And you know about ivy, right? If ivy grows along a wall, or, you know, as a baseball fan, I think about the ivy at Wrigley Field where the Chicago Cubs play. It covers the outfield wall. It's kind of cool. Wrigley Field is awesome. So ivy can cover are ruins of past purpose. Past patience. Yeah, no, past, wrecked past purpose. So he's really saying here that when ivy grows over a wall or an old house, it can smooth out the rough edges. You don't see the imperfections, the broken corners underneath, and it makes it into something new. And so Hopkins kind of says, if we have patience, it's kind of like our heart's ivy. And it covers over our ruins of wrecked past purpose. So, hey, our plans that didn't work out in the past, our failures even, God can kind of cover this over with this virtue of patience. And so, yeah, this is kind of interesting. This is what God's grace is all about. And this is why Hopkins writes, yet the rebellious wills of us, we do bid God bend to him even so. We want to fight sometimes. We want to fight against God. And we don't want to make these acts of self-denial. We don't want to pick up our cross. We don't want to be obedient. But we can accept that. We can accept that. We ask God to bend our will to His. And that's why He says patience, it's a hard thing. It's a hard thing. It's hard to be patient with yourself. It's hard to be patient with others. But this is really what it's all about, because God is infinitely patient. That's why He hasn't, you know, come in judgment yet. He's patient with us, and He's waiting. He's hoping for many, many to repent. And that's why we have to keep preaching the gospel. That's what it's all about. So yeah, thanks for sending me that poem, Lucas. Really appreciate that. And happy birthday to Dr. Holly Ordway. What a fun show today. Everything from dad hats to poets from the 19th century to who wrote the Gospel of John. That was an eclectic hour. It was a lot of fun to spend it with you. We'll be back tomorrow. Timory is up next, so stay tuned, followed by the Family Rosary Across America. Lucas Holt produced, Patrick Alog took your calls. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.